All right, then I would like to introduce now for a message for you ladies this morning, one of the ministers in United. He and Bev live in Indianapolis, Indiana. You probably know he pastors two churches there in Indiana. Vic also, though, you know, he's a world traveler. Most of you are familiar with founder of LifeNets. He and Bev work together in LifeNets. You'll be hearing more from Bev later tomorrow. But Vic also is the senior pastor of our churches in the Nordic. He said, you know, it's Norway, Iceland, Denmark, that area they call the Nordic countries, and Eastern Europe. And so he makes trips over there to serve those brethren. And then probably the toughest job of all is being on the Council of Elders. And Vic has been on the Council of Elders. He and I were on it together the first 5 years, but Vic is one of the few members who has been on the Council of Elders from the founding of United to this day, today. So I'd like to introduce Mr. Vic Kubik.
Thank you, Benny. And I don't know where to begin credits. You know, usually you want to say a few nice things about all kinds of people. And first of all, I do want to say thank you to Denny and Leanne Luker for inviting us to this wonderful event. You know, we just thoroughly appreciate not only being invited to something like this, but their friendship. It goes back a long ways, and it goes back to our days in working in Southern California when we worked both in the Los Angeles area. And we got to know each other very well then and had some projects we worked on together. And we found out that we had very similar ways that we thought and the way we looked at people and the way we viewed people. And we got to be very good friends then with Denny and Leanne, a friendship that has remained to this day. Also, I'd like to thank Bev Pronishan, who contacted us first. I didn't really know who she was. I mean, it's a name that you see everywhere, but you don't really. I didn't know who she was. But she's the one who contacted me, you know, about getting the proper title of the program. And she stayed with me until she got something from me, you know. and even got sure we got the right date for this event and, you know, other factors. But it's also great to see a lot of people that I have not seen in a long time. Barbara Parada, who the last time I saw her was in San Salvador, El Salvador, before she was married. I see Mrs. Hardison here, Mary Roscoe, Mrs. Ashland, who I'm just seeing from a distance. It's just, you know, and I'm leaving all kinds of names out here, but it's good to see all of you here, and we just really appreciate this opportunity. Unfortunately, we have to leave right after the service here, so I will not be saying too much more in that area, but get right into my topic. When talking about women of valor, the woman that is most immediate in my mind as a woman who showed a great deal of the courage, which valor means, and the ability to face tribulation, and who has a very special place with God most of all, is my mother. Probably next is Bev, who is probably very, very similar to my mother in nature, and perhaps I was led to Bev because of a very similar nature that my mother had. But the title is Valor, Faith, and a Pearl of Great Price, My Mother's Journey. And it's a title that I worked on for a while, and Bev at first said, you know, is that a little too much? Is that a little bit over the top with all the things that you say there? And then she came back to me and said, no, I think that's right. You know, when I really think of her life, I think that all those factors are there. But my mother's life was a most interesting experience, and I'd like to share that with you because it does have quite a number of lessons for all of us, ladies and men, because she truly was a woman of great valor. My parents were refugees after the World War II and lived in a refugee camp in Germany for 4 years. They had no country. They were just like refugees you see on television. They have no passports, no nationality. They're just people stuck someplace until somebody can figure out what to do with them. And that's what they were in for 4 years, and that's where I was born. I was born in a United Nations refugee camp, a DP camp, a displaced persons camp, and we were called DPs when we came to the United States. My parents, as we were growing up, would tell us the stories about how they survived the war and how they came to the United States. But you know, as kids, that's the last thing we really wanted to hear. We just didn't want to hear, because when my mom would talk, she would start crying. She'd talk about the mother that she left and had missed so badly and couldn't see. She talked about all the things that happened, the bombing and the war. And, you know, all we wanted to do was to go play ball. You know, we just wanted to get away from the crying and just go outside. And so as I grew up, I had a lot of little pieces to her story, but never the whole story in one chronological, you know, event. Well, my father died at a very young age of age 42, and my mother died at the age of 58. And a few years ago, I know that they had friends in Canada that they were very close to who had the whole story and who I could verify the whole story with. They lived in Edmonton, Alberta. And so Bev and I went up there in 2003, very good friends of theirs who we have known through the years. And I said, I just want you to tell me the whole story, because here's what I know, tell me what you know. And they had the story down. So I recorded about 4 hours of video of them telling the story and wrote it down. And I'd like to tell you part of what had happened. The end result in my parents' life was that they both ended up in the faith. They both died in the faith, in the church. And what led to their being in the church is a story of tribulation to love, friendship, survival, courage, liberation, and triumph. It really is quite a story. And even when I reviewed it this morning, you know, just reading it through one more time just to have it fresh in my mind, tears came to my eyes, because it is really quite a story of a person's life. They were refugees who had gone through the tribulation and survived. And when my parents came into the church, and the first booklets they got were 1975 and Prophecy and stories about the Great Tribulation and the Day of the Lord, they said, you know, we've been there. You know, we understand what this nation will go through, because they literally did go through what many people biblically are prophesied to go through as the tribulation. The story begins with the invasion of the Soviet Union by the Germans, one of the biggest operations ever. It's called Operation Barbarossa. Nazi Germany's attack on June 22, 1941, when they amassed 3 million troops, 3,300 tanks, and crossed the Russian border very suddenly. Initial blitzkrieg devastated city after city. The Germans made quick headway with little resistance. The Germans then forcefully and methodically deported millions of Ukrainians and others, Belarusians and Russians, to Germany to work in the factories and farms, because all the men were in the service, and the women in Germany and the slave labor they could get from these areas provided the labor for Germany. The majority of Germany's labor force was very tied up with having to support a two-front war with the Soviet Union, which was the most savage of all wars, to the fighting against the British and the Americans in Africa, Italy, and later D-Day, and what happened the next year. The Germans came to my mother's town. My mother lived 50 miles south of Kharkov, which is a city of about 2 million, and her city was a city of 50,000, called Lichachev, or 70,000 people. The Germans, in the initial air raid, killed 700 people. That's my mother's first recollection of the war. And she was, at that time, 15 years old. My mother was herding cows from the field when she was coming back to the house, and the German bombers came over and bombed all around where she was. And she hid under the cows. And she was shaking, and she came home just horribly terrified, a 15-year-old girl. And to the day that she died, she still had trembling hands that go back to that very first trauma of being so close to being in a bombardment, not knowing if the next bomb will kill you. But that was only the first of many bombings that my mother endured. The Germans, in about a year from that time, came in and told they came in, and usually they came to the courthouse and got the names of the people in town and sent a letter to everybody, to every family, saying, we want to have so-and-so appear at the train station the next day for going to Germany. And usually one teenager from every family was taken and put on boxcars and just shipped across Poland and into Germany. My mother was one of those teenagers. Actually, the Germans told the teenagers and made it sound fun. They said, this is only for 3 to 6 months. You'll be back home. And, you know, young people, they thought this was kind of fun. This was an adventure to go and be in Germany. And actually, of all places, one of the safest places during World War II was Germany itself. It wasn't until the carpet bombing by the British and the Americans at the very end of the war, when Germany really was a burning inferno. But until that time, Germany was relatively safe place. I mean, it wasn't being invaded, except for some cities that were bombed occasionally. And my mother worked in a city called Magdeburg, about 50 miles west of Berlin, between Berlin and Hanover, as a modest-sized city on the Elbe River. And she worked in a shoe factory. Conditions for foreign workers were very harsh. She remembers just day after day of having nothing but carrot soup. That's all they had. Strict controls were imposed on their movement and on weekends. They had to wear a big yellow patch that said Ost, O-S-T, which means East. And they weren't allowed to walk on sidewalks. They had to walk wherever they could find, but not on the sidewalks. That was reserved for Germans. So they had to walk sometimes in the street. And they were treated as second-class citizens, obviously, even though they were working for free for the Germans as slave laborers. But the Germans had very little regard for people from the East. One cannot understand the present-day Russian mindset, or even the whole Soviet mindset, without appreciating what that nation went through in World War II. Now, we as a nation know what we had gone through. You may have memories from either your parents or yourself from the sacrifices and the trials that our nation went through in World War II. But the Soviet casualties were unbelievable. 15 million military deaths. That's 30 times more than the total U.S. military deaths in both the Pacific and European theaters. Of those who went into the Red Army at age 19, only 1 in 100 returned. Even the Germans marveled as to how little respect the Soviet commanders had for their own people. Battle deaths were numbered in the hundreds of thousands. After the war, the ratio of men to women was 100 women to 60 men. And in 1967, Dr. Hay, who you might remember back from the days of where we were in the Worldwide Church of God, went to the Soviet Union for the 50th anniversary of the Soviet Revolution. They had a special national celebration, and lots of groups went there. And he marveled when he saw and looked out at the population. He said, you know, there's nobody my age. I don't see anybody my age. And that was true. There was a certain group of men that was totally wiped out from the society. And the Soviets are still traumatized, even to this day, trying to catch up. The battle deaths, again, Bev and I have taken YOU trips that we've led to the USSR and just saw the huge memorials to the deaths that pale into insignificance, anything, any place on the earth. In Kharkov, the city north of my mother, they had a cemetery for the, it was called for the those who fought and died in the liberation of Kharkov. And we see all these gravestones. So we walk up to them. Each gravestone was for 14,000 men. I mean, it was just, the devastation was just, is beyond description of what we can think. So when my parents said they went through the tribulation, they went through mass death and witnessed it and saw it. When we had a family reunion in 1988, I wrote an article in the Plain Truth magazine about that, and visited with my uncles in the city where my mother was bombed, you know, and so forth. They showed me exactly what happened, and they told me then that that city was bombed several more times by the Germans, to where every home was destroyed, and they lived 3 years in root cellars, you know, at that time, and survived on the summer gardens. I found a few letters after my mother died that gave me a little bit of a glimpse of her correspondence with her brothers and herself when she lived in Germany. I was surprised there was even any mail service, which wasn't, you know, very good. But here's a letter written from her brother Victor on June 7th, 1943, 1 year after she was in Germany. "Greetings, dear Nina, from your brother Victor. In the first lines of our short letter from our family, we send you greetings. Nina, are you all right? You write that you are getting lonely living on foreign soil, but you're not the only one separated from their family. Many people are finding themselves in this condition. Nina, we are not receiving your letters. In 1943, we have received only two postcards from you, one dated January 20th and the other dated February 8th, which we received in June. Nina, you are writing and asking about your brother Alex in the service. We have not heard from him in 2 years. If we live, we will meet again. The weather is good for growing. The gardens look good, and we will have things to eat in the winter. The Russians came in February, but the Germans came back in March. This is the news, the town news, you know. The German armies came through in February, the Russians, you know, drove them out in March. And from another aunt, we heard that that town changed sides 6 times during the war. On the front lines, there has been no shooting, but in May, many people in other neighboring villages have died. The land is covered with blood, and the end of the war is not in sight. We're tired of the war." And surprisingly, all my mother's brothers came back from the war alive, which was probably just very, very rare. "You said that you'd like to see the flowers in the homeland again. That would be wonderful. But the land now is ravaged by war. I think often of your cheerful smile and your kind words to us, my loving sister. Mom and Dad and your sister Tonya work on the collective farm, but I work on the railroad. Please write and let us know what you are eating and are the Germans good to you. We have not been receiving your letters. Please give greetings to your friends with whom you are working." Then, after my mother died, I received this letter from my Aunt Tonya that she refers to. She says, "My dear nephews and nieces," this was about 1985, "your mother had a hard life. In the years of the war, our village changed hands 6 times between the Russians and the Germans. The oldest and the youngest were evacuated, but your mother, Nina, stayed behind where all the fighting took place. And I still remember one moment when your mother was leading a cow home and had a frightened look on her face after the Germans bombed our town. Then the Germans took our village and took Nina, you know, to Germany." And these are stories that you read out of kind of a novel, but this is the story of my mother. My mother lived in Germany, and I have a whole story to tell also about my father, but I'm trying to focus here on my mother at this time. She lived there in the slave labor camp, where she worked in a shoe factory, throughout the war. But then towards the end of the war, the British and the Americans were coming through to liberate that area. Now, you know, we hear all these glorious stories of war, the American bombers, you know, liberation and so forth. What is not told is what those bombers did to the regular people and what happened, you know, down below. And many of the cities like Dresden, which was not too far from Magdeburg, were 1 square mile was bombed and burned out, you know, every night. You know, they just kept going square mile to square mile to square mile. And tens and hundreds of thousands, you know, of people died. And it was a war in which there were as many or more civilian deaths than military deaths. It was total war. Something that World War I was the last of military wars. World War II was a total war in which the whole society is attacked, destroyed, and ravaged. My mother remembers air raid after air raid, and towards the end of the war, they were going into the air raids, bunkers, almost every night. And the air raid would sound, and she said that sometimes they were so tired of going and running into the bunkers that they just stayed outside and just watched all the bombing. It was almost like watching the fireworks, because if you're going to get killed, you're going to get killed. It was an attitude of, you know, destiny that overtook them in that fashion. But the bunkers, or the places that they hid out, were zigzagged concrete tunnels. And they were made such that if a bomb did fall on one of had a direct hit. Only the people in that section would be killed. It would not have sent this devastation down the whole tunnel. And she said every night, you know, some section of the bunkers would get hit. And they'd be taking out her friends, you know, bringing out dead people. But they kind of got used to it. That maybe tomorrow will be my day, maybe not. But they lived with that type of attitude. Toward the end of the war, my mother and my father became friends. My father worked, you know, my mother worked in a shoe factory. My father worked in a factory that made jam. You know, he had a nice place to work. But nonetheless, it was the same type of thing, you know, it was a food, you know, confectionery place. And I told you about my friends in Canada. They also had my mother's best friend, because they came from the same village together, kind of like buddies, and they lived together in the same shoe factory. And then my dad, who came from Western Ukraine, and this other fellow, also from Western Ukraine, befriended my mom, and they were like boyfriend and girlfriend. My mother was 16 when the Germans took her, and she got to know my dad when she was, you know, 17, 18 years old. And when the war was over, she was 19 years old. These are kids. You know, my mother would talk to me about the war, and it would sound like she was an older woman. You know, kids, you know, they were just teenagers. And this is what they lived with. Well, the war was coming to an end, and they heard the Americans come in, and the American army rolled in. Just what a different attitude. Even the Germans were happy that the Americans had come in. Americans were laughing and joking. They brought all kinds of candy, chocolate, hams, all kinds of things that they just spread out. It was just an unbelievable spirit, you know, of the Americans. They said the Americans brought in a spirit that they hadn't, you know, seen before. And so they were thankful now. Freedom at last. We are free. That is not the way it ended up. Because there was a conference between Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt, the Potsdam Conference, in which they divided how Europe would be partitioned, decided how Europe would be partitioned after the war. So even though Patton moved all the way into Czechoslovakia, and even though the Americans moved into Magdeburg, and, you know, got just a little bit past there, the lines were drawn on where they pre-decided they would be. So a few days after this liberation by the Americans, all of a sudden they hear Russian voices. They wake up in the morning and they're hearing that everybody's speaking Russian. The Americans left and the Russians came in. And all these slave workers, my mom, dad, were all rounded up and treated like traitors. They were treated as they were collaborators with the enemy. And all they were just teenagers that were just hauled on boxcars to work in Germany. What were they going to do? And they did work in Germany. They were questioned incessantly. They were interrogated. They were treated very badly. They made certain ones walk long distances, and they were in a transition camp. My mom and dad were on the east side of the river, of the Elbe River, which is a major river. It's not one that you just kind of a creek that you swim over. It was a major river. It runs north and south. And the Americans, of course, in their conquest, had thrown over, you know, these bridges very, very quick. The Army Corps of Engineers, it's amazing how many things they did so quickly, and they just turn them over to the Russians and just say, you know, just, you know, take it. And the Russians, you know, took over this area. These bridges across the Elbe River were all bombed out just a month before that. There was one occasion where my mother, the Germans, what they were doing was putting slave laborers on the bridges as the Americans would bomb, because, you know, they used them as human shields. And my mother was about to march onto one of those bridges, and she was snatched off by my dad and the other friends, and that's how they, you know, got away from that. But they could have very well been on one of the bridges, and many of the slave laborers died that way because the Americans were indiscriminate. They would notify Americans that, okay, you can bomb, you know, it's all yours, but, you know, there's a lot of people on those bridges. So that's kind of the way that happened. Anyway, the foursome was in a transition camp, and it really wasn't, you know, guarded all that well, but my parents were had a window to the outside. And my father was volunteering to kind of work with horses. And I'm not sure exactly what he did with horses, but he's able to get out of that transition camp and kind of maneuver his way around. This was the summer of 1945. And what he did was one day got himself all the way across the border, about 50 miles away, and talked to a few guards if they would let them across the border, see if they could talk to a couple of guards. And the guard said, okay, let's make a deal. He said, if you give me a watch, a suit, and a bottle of vodka, it's a deal. So that was the payment for their lives. They had no idea if they'd be betrayed. They had no idea if they'd come there, give them those items, and then just be shot or anything. But my parents and this other couple, a foursome, was able to slip out from this compound that they were in and got out and took the train, unbelievably, to the border, got to the guards with a bottle of vodka, a suit, and a watch, came to the guard. These needed three bribes because the guard had to bribe the next guard or next to him and the guard to his other side. And right at midnight, at the change of the guards, he let my parents through across the border, which was to the British zone. Germany was divided into four zones, and this was the border between the German or the Russian and the British zone. My parents ran along with another couple. The four of them ran, and the rustling was heard, and he started shooting from the other end into darkness at somebody that was out there. My parents ran and ran and ran. They said they ran, it must have been at least about 3 miles, until they could run no longer and they felt like they were safe. And they ended up in what now is, you know, West Germany, or it's all Germany now, but this was in the British zone. And they worked themselves over to Hanover, where the United Nations was already setting up, you know, displaced persons camps. And they were told that they came into a place that was supposed to be a camp. There was housing that was all bombed out, and they said, make something of it, you know. Just, there was no roof, there was nothing, no windows, it was all destroyed. And my dad and his friend, you know, they kind of worked this. After the feast in 1986 in Brno, I went back to this camp. I wanted to see exactly where this was, because that's where I was born. And I wanted to have, because we had another friend of the family who went back to this camp. And I told the German people who were running, and it was basically a police academy for border police with West East Germany. And then it became a school for SWAT, you know, policemen. And they let me in. I told them that, you know, I was born here and everything, and they got real nice. I told them exactly the address and so forth, and I went right up to the house where, you know, my mom and dad had lived. My mom and dad lived in this camp from 45. In fact, the day they came to the camp, they just heard on the news that the bomb was dropped in Hiroshima. So that was the date. It was in July, August there of 1945. Their friends were able to get out of the camp because they found an uncle in Canada. They had a Canadian soldier go back and put an ad in the paper, in the Alberta newspaper, saying, hi, I'm Walter, I'm in Germany in a camp. If you, Uncle so-and-so, are reading this, call me. And Uncle found him. He found the ad in the paper, and he sponsored him to the United to Canada in 1946. My parents were looking for somebody. You couldn't go someplace unless you had a sponsor. They were looking for somebody in Australia. They had other friends go to Brazil, Argentina. They were looking for asylum in Australia. They couldn't find anybody. But finally, in 1949, through people that my parents knew, through a University of Minnesota professor, Dr. Gronowski, they found a sponsor. And he sponsored our family, the United States. And my family and I, who was 2 years old, came over on a troop ship to Ellis Island. And my brothers, my siblings and I even got a plaque, you know, put on that, you know, place, you know, the Kubik family there on Ellis Island, you know, where many, many hundreds of thousands of families had come through. And from there, they were whisked by train to southern Minnesota, where the sponsor got them a job working at an apple orchard in Faribault, Minnesota. So here are my parents. They moved to Minnesota next year to Minneapolis, St. Paul area. And all the immigrants start finding one another. It's like after survival, you know, they say, oh, you're Ukrainian, yeah, I'm Ukrainian, what happened to you, here's all this. And about 100 families found each other in St. Paul, Minnesota, and formed a church, Orthodox Church. This was my mother's first experience with religion, because in Ukraine, where she was living, it was communist atheism. It wasn't that she was irreligious, she was just a-religious. I mean, God was just not part of their lives. But she never felt comfortable in the Orthodox Church. My dad was really gung-ho. He was one of the trustees. He was an artisan. He helped paint a lot of the beautiful paintings in the church. He did the carving and artwork. I mean, my dad could do all kinds of things. And he was on the board of trustees, and they formed this church. Now, my mother tells me this story, and you'll have to kind of excuse me if it sounds a little bit odd. But on the troop ship going over to the United States, she saw a flash of a little white building. And it flashed again. And she couldn't make out what that was. And so she didn't really pay much attention to it, but she did see something that was, quote, maybe a vision. But she, you know, nothing was spoken, nothing was said. She saw a white building. Well, my mother and dad were in the church. In 1961, I heard the World Tomorrow program for the first time on the radio, and I began writing for the literature. And I began receiving a Plain Truth magazine, and my mother and I talked about what I was learning. But it was like contraband, because community, the Ukrainian community, was so close. They were more closer because of the relationship and survival of the war than the religion itself. But it's church on Sunday and their social events and the Ukrainian culture that kept them together. Remember, my parents didn't really, you know the language. My parents, though, did become citizens of the United States, and that was a time when it was a little bit different becoming a citizen. For one thing, you had to know the English language well. You know, you couldn't just show up and say, hola, you know, or whatever, you know, or say something in Vietnamese, you know, and get your, you know. You had to know the English language. You had to know about how the American government was structured. My dad was studying here, legislative branch, executive branch, judicial branch, you know. They had to learn all this type of thing, you know. They had to know who their state senators, you know, the senator from Minnesota was. They had to know who the governor was. They had to know who the president was. They had to know all these things to become citizens. And my parents did both become citizens of the United States. In second grade, I became a citizen. What was I before I was an American citizen? Nothing. I had no passport. I had nothing. I was a man without a country. But my parents became citizens. But in 1961, my mother started taking an interest in what I was studying. She wouldn't order it for herself because it was something that she wouldn't want to disappoint my father. But she read and she studied all this with me all those years. In 1965, I applied to Ambassador College, which my mother was okay with, but we kept it semi-secret from my dad. He didn't think that I really would do that, because his ambition for me was to go to the Institute of Technology at the University of Minnesota, where all other successful people went. You know, I was a techie, that's what my future would be, and that's what his dream was for me. But I wanted to go to Ambassador College, and that was a point of great travail in our family. And I was accepted to Ambassador College, and the minister came out to my home. My parents were on vacation, the only vacation they took in a long time, and talked to me, and I said, I've already applied to Ambassador College. I said, should I go? He said, well, what do you think? Should you go? You know, you idiot. You know, of course you should go. I just knew that it was going to be a very, very traumatic moment with my parents. And my parents came a day early from vacation, not on Sunday, but on Friday. And they came to church services with me in Minnesota, Minneapolis. It was probably in one of the lesser desired parts of Minneapolis, in the south part of town. And it was not a happy moment. And they barred me from going to college. I was 17 years old at the time. But during that year, a great miracle occurred, is that my parents began to study both now, my father and my mother, who was really for it. And they invited the minister to come to their home, who was Sherwin McMichael at that time, who stayed till 2 o'clock, maybe even later, in the morning. And they began coming to services. And later that year, they were baptized. This was a huge move on my mother's and my dad's part, leaving the community, leaving the safety and security of people who speak your language, leaving the Orthodox Church, which was wonderful, awesome, and great to these people, as compared to what's this thing out of California. You know, my parents, when they left the church at that time, it was a major earthquake, you know, in our church because of who they were and that they would go with a group like this. I went to Bassett College the next year, and my mother, at the end of that year, in a very sudden way, my father died. He died of a heart attack. He suffered so much in the war, and that's a whole story of itself, because he was put into a concentration camp the last year and a half before he and my mother, you know, reunited and left for, you know, the West. But my dad died at age 42. My mother was left with 5 children. The next year, the Lukers came to Minneapolis, and they were her pastor. My mother, again, I was in college. I think by the time the Lukers came, my brother then went to college, and all 3 of us boys went to Ambassador College. My mother lived 3 miles from services. She was very well known as a person who was hospitable. The highest position that she got in life was to be a cleaning woman. She was on third tithe and was a cleaning woman. She was 40 years old when my dad died. But she was a woman that always opened her home to people. It was the place to go to after services, because we had morning church at 10 o'clock, and right after church at 12 o'clock, lots of people just went over to her home. They brought food. She always had food. She was an amazing woman for, you know, for all the things that had happened, to stay focused on doing right things, to doing good things. She always watched out for people. She always, when somebody was sick, she was there to visit. She wasn't part of any kind of a program. She wasn't part of any kind of a list. She just did these things. Bev, who lived about 25 miles south, started attending church. And my mother and another lady went to visit her, just like a visiting program. Just women just deciding to visit a new person that had come into church. And Bev still remembers that very well. Anyway, my mother was a person that was highly respected. In 1984, and I was the pastor of the church in Minneapolis South, which is just across the river from the, where my mother was in church, we found that she told us that she had the flu and just really had a hard time going to work. And she was the kind of person that she went to work even when she was sick. Well, she had the flu so bad, and then she had a dental appointment, and the dentist said, you know, your gums are bleeding just in a way that I don't really like the way they're bleeding, you know. You better have this checked out. She did have it checked out. It was acute leukemia. And 3 weeks later, she was dead. It would just happen that quickly. She decided not to go through all the transfusions because it was a very painful process, and one which she already told it was terminal. She came to our home, and she died there, and Bev took care of her, all her functions and everything with her the last days of her life. But we did receive, and the funeral was, there were so many people, I could not believe how many people came to my mother's funeral because of what she represented and the way that she lived her life and her obedience to the faith that was very, very clear. I told you about the little building that flashed in her mind. Well, she opened up, this was back when we were studying, a copy of the autobiography. And here she sees this Grange House, you know, building in Oregon, that Mr. Armstrong was preaching in. She said, "That's the building." She said, "That's exactly what I saw. You know, that's what I saw." It somehow, it really clicked. Now, you know, that's the story she told. She told it several times. But it was something that, it was something that she had seen on the ship, and it really, really impressed her when she saw it. And obviously that wasn't the thing that drew her into the faith, but it was just an interesting side thing. One of the people who came to my mother's funeral was our neighboring pastor, John Bald. John Bald was a very, very good friend of ours, and he wrote an article for the United News back in 2001 about, called Crowns of Glory. It was about elderly seniors, it was about senior citizens. In fact, my mother used to hate to be called a senior citizen. She was 58, you know, and they had these senior citizens things that Wisconsin dealt with 55 and up. She says, "I'm not going to those things because I'm not a senior citizen." You know, she was just, you know. But anyway, John Bald wrote this article about senior citizens, and he says, I like to read parts of it. "I'm reminded of a truly outstanding example of a senior citizen in the church, now deceased. She was Nina Kubik, the mother of Victor Kubik, a member of the Council of Elders. During World War II, she was a teenage slave laborer in Germany, taken by the Nazis when they invaded Ukraine, then part of the Soviet Union. After the war, she married and lived in a displaced persons camp for 4 years. In 1949, she, being pregnant with her son, Oli, her husband, Igor, and son, Victor, emigrated from Hanover, Germany, to the United States. The family traveled with a group of friends and acquaintances and settled as a group in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area of Minnesota. The group of Ukrainians lived in close proximity to one another and assisted one another in adjusting to a very different way of life. In doing so, they quite naturally formed very close bonds and ties. Later, Mrs. Kubik was called into the church, and this markedly changed her lifestyle and her priorities. She had less time than previously to spend with her friends in the Ukrainian community, which in most cases she was shunned by them. As time went on, this concerned her deeply as she tried to serve both the needs of the church and her Ukrainian friends. So great was her concern that she left instructions that a letter be read at her funeral by the presiding minister, which was read by Noel Horner, who conducted this sermon. This was done. My wife and I were privileged to be able to attend her funeral and to hear her words, coming, as it were, from the grave. In the letter, she stated that she realized that in recent years she had not spent as much time with her Ukrainian friends as she had previously, but she wanted them to know that it was not because she thought any less of them. She stated that she wanted them to know that the reason was that she had found the pearl of great price, and that she felt compelled to pursue the way which was pictured in the Bible as that incomparable pearl. John Bald continues, "This was one of the most moving experiences of my life, and I was very impressed by her expressed concern for her longtime friends, as well as the need she felt to serve the God she had learned about in the Bible." And that truly was an amazing moment, because my mother had spoken to us, and she had written that letter to give, she gave it to me to give to Noel Horner. She wanted read. She said, "I love you," and she said that, "It's not that I think any less of you, but I have found the pearl of great price." And she was referring to the truth of God that was burned into her heart by God. And she stuck with it. She told us, you know, as you know, the three sons, you know, her three sons, she says, "You don't ever leave the church and the faith." You know, she was one of the crusaders for the faith, of the things that she very deeply believed in. And it was, you know, we all, at that time, several of us siblings lived in the Twin Cities, and, you know, my brother, and we would go to church. The Feast of Trumpets, after she died in August, was so different without her. But she was such an amazing person for standing up for what was right and true. The scripture in Isaiah, which says, "Oh, God sometimes removes people from the evil to come." My parents had gone through so much evil, and I'm glad they didn't have to face the evil of some of the disruptions that we've had, you know, in the church, because that would have been devastating, you know, to them. Because, again, as I said, when they talked about the war, and when they talked about prophecy, and they talked about what would happen in the future, she said, "We have gone through the tribulation. We know, kids, what it's like." you know it when you have bombs falling around you, and when in the morning you find out that this friend died and that friend died, and then you just have to go on. You have to go to work the next day. And then the next day the bombs come from the British and the Americans, and more of your friends die. And you have no idea where your life will be. You're just being drawn into a transition camp, and then you're fleeing, and then you are on a troop ship, and then you're in the United States, and then you're faced with this and that, not knowing. And to stand up and to be able to walk and to be able to steer a course of stability, relying upon God, is quite an example. Sometimes I find myself, you know, with different traumas and say, what am I going to do and everything? I haven't gone through any trials. Nobody's bombed me. Nobody's shot at me. Nobody's, you know, done anything to me. I look to the example of my mother as one who had so much that was a factor that was hard that I take comfort in the fact that she made it through all that. And God has taken their lives and has preserving them for the kingdom of God. So I wanted to share this story with you about my mother, because I truly, it's emblazoned in me. I haven't told this story in 2 years now, not since I told part of it in Spokane 2 years ago. But it is a story of courage, of valor, the kind of courage and valor that a woman can exhibit in a very powerful way, not as a strong leader, but in the way that they live their life and the choices they make and the reliance upon God to get them through this or that situation. So again, it's been wonderful being here. I'm sorry that we have to leave so soon, but we have to go. We work Saturdays.